So there, I ask about people. I said it's diverse. Wilder D. Bancroft, physical chemistry, Harvard educated, and very much Harvard in his manners and customs, carried the green book bag up of Harvard Yard with him all his life there, built a place nearby. In chemical microscopy, you don't hear anything about that now, but that was the actual seat of all learning in chemical microscopy. A Frenchman by the name of Émile Chameau. Started the course. Well, we have to go back to Louis Monroe Dennis, because Dennis was the first head of the department and the only head of the department right up to the time he retired. There was an earlier one, but Dennis was the dynamo who established and enlarged and ran the Department of Chemistry at Cornell from the early days right up until the time I left there. He was trained in inorganic chemistry, Moisson and the German people. Got his doctorate degree in Germany, believed thoroughly in Carl Baum Schering reagents and in the German glassware. What was it called?
Jena glass, yes,
and it, of course, it was very fresh or broke easily, subject to thermal shock, but it did not put glassware constituent in the preparations you had inside the flask or beaker. That was what convinced Dennis that we should use it all the time. So he went to Germany every summer and bought the supply of reagents and the whole glassware for the place, brought it back. The organic chemist hated that glassware because he had something set up and put a burner under it and crack it would go and so on before Pyrex. But Dennis pointed out very definitely that Pyrex put boron and yes, silicon and some alkali reagents in anything you boiled in it. In fact, he had a neat lecture demonstration of this. Take a piece of Pyrex and pound it to a powder, grind it up in a mortar, put it in distilled water overnight or until the next class, filter off the water, evaporate it on a watch glass, and there's the white residue. Sure, it was there, so. All right, it was only after Dennis retired that other people, Papish, chemical microscopy, that was especially analytical chemical microscopy, a big thing at Cornell then. Such things as gas and fuel analysis and of course, industrial chemistry, big course in that. A very diverse department, a lot of people who were diverse in their training and personalities and background, but they got along together. Why did they get along so well together? And Dennis was an absolute commander, an autocrat at the top. His word was law and everything. He handed out all the money from endowments for research and equipment. He designed the building, the Baker Laboratory. He went out and got the money to build it. He established the Baker non-resident lectureships, famous series of books, right on through Pauling, Nature of the Chemical Bonds. It's from one of the books. So Well, because he was an autocrat, he had the whole thing under his thumb, and he ran it just so, the way he was sure it should be run. You can imagine a lot of resentment boiled under the surface, so that when he retired, then they wanted to switch everything around and get rid of all the customs that he had set up. The university, the chemistry museum, for example, and all that. So, yeah, history of Cornell. I won't go any further with that, but it was Dennis who, you might say, noticed me. Why did he notice me? Well, I had to apply for a job there, and of course, since Dennis was in charge of everything, we went to him for the job of preparing and setting out the reagents to begin with. And he would go through the laboratory and inspect our work with an eagle eye. He taught us a remarkable course in inorganic chemistry. It would be called advanced inorganic chemistry now. Gave a set of demonstration lectures. So came a time when he needed a lecture assistant, show the slides, set up the experiments, wash up afterward, and so on. And I applied for it, and he chose me, and that's how I got in with Dennis. And Dennis, what were his research interests? Fourth group chemistry. Well, particularly, say more accurately, the rare elements. Gallium, germanium, indium, and so on. He bored in where no one else saw any reason to go do research there. That's, if you wonder what this sound is. They send around the mail call after when the mail is in.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so there's a bell for mail. That particular time when I was graduate student, Dennis was particularly gung-ho for germanium. And very few people knew anything about it, but he found a particular source of germanium, which he called germanite. It was a complex sulfide of copper, silver, germanium, zinc, mixed sulfide. So he would set his assistants busy extracting the germanium from this complicated mineral. That was quite a task. Start with 100 pounds of germanite and powder it and cook it up with nitric acid and separate various metals. A sort of glorified quantitative analysis. And finally, the last step was to precipitate germanium disulfide from a neutral solution. I can picture right now very clearly a white sulfide. How many white sulfides do you know?
No.
Actually, there's only one other one in the whole periodic table. And that zinc sulfide used for years as a pigment in paints. But of course, it does turn color. All right, germanium sulfide, and when I got a Heckscher research grant, then after the lecture assistantship, I was put on preparing new compounds of germanium. The organometallic compounds struck my fancy then. I thought, that's a very interesting area. Gee, think of making volatile, distillable, very interesting compounds of these elements that we consider ordinarily just just metals, or metalloids, if you will, exists, of course, in geochemistry and mineralogy and inorganic chemistry, but the idea of organic derivatives, that seemed fascinating to me. So, first preparation I did for Dennis that resulted in the publication was to make indium trimethyl. Didn't know indium from a hole in the ground when I went to Cornell, but a very interesting element, an interesting history, which I won't go into here. But I knew about organogermanium compounds and by relation organosilicon compounds, and then the Seister came an event that was made a decisive difference in my life and in all the subsequent history of silicon and organosilicon compounds. I told her Dennis had established the George Fisher Baker non-resident lectureships. He brought in a man for a semester, or preferably a whole year, who stayed there and gave lectures and participated in the department and guided graduate students if he wanted to, and in the end, he had to write a book. Well, Dennis invited Alfred Stock from that time, from Karlsruhe in Baden, southern southwest Germany, to come give lectures. Well, Alfred Stock was a very hard-headed, stubborn, determined German. He didn't know any English. And Dennis said, "That's all right, come lecture in German, it'll be good for the students to to listen to it and to learn," and so on. Of course, his audience dwindled down, but Stock had some great ideas, of course. He developed a vacuum system for preparing, purifying, isolating, identifying, and studying compounds that were sensitive to air and moisture, and used this to make boron hydrides. The whole sequence of boron hydrides begins with Alfred Stock. Remarkable techniques he developed, working with tiny, tiny amounts in the form of their vapors in the all completely enclosed in glass vacuum chain. He devised and made by his own glass blowing mercury valves, so you could transfer something from flask A to flask B, send the vapor over, but not expose it to stopcock grease. He used a mercury valve, raised level of the mercury, and shut off the flow of gas and mercury manometers and so on and so on. The result was that Alfred Stock got mercury poisoning. His first devices he used were old-fashioned uniometers, a long graduated tube like a burette closed at one end, and you stuck this down in a great pool of mercury, like a picture a soapstone sink, maybe 2.5 feet wide and 1.5 feet deep, and of course containing mercury at least 1 foot deep. And he would plunge his arms in that, up to his forearms in, up to the elbows, and introduce the gas into the uniometer and so on. Result was he got mercury poisoning, and that's a horrible malady to have for most of your life, because it sensitizes the poor victim, and he can never again come near mercury. It just has to avoid it at all costs. So Stock was an interesting fellow in that he devised methods for determining mercury in bread and in milk, especially in beer. Everything that came into his household had to be tested for mercury. He himself avoided anything that might have mercury in it, like a felt hat. He came to Cornell. All right. First thing he wanted was to have everything done the way it was done in Germany. I don't know how many of tales about stock you've come across, but I covered just two or three, because he was put up at the new student union at Cornell, Willard Strait Hall, a tiny room up on the third floor, and he was disturbed because the students working at the desk in the lobby didn't understand German. He had to get somebody to come and interpret, tell them what to do. And okay, came the first Sunday morning he was there, he marched down in the lobby and demanded his mail. And they tried to explain to him they don't deliver any mail on Sundays. Well, in Germany, he got mail on Sunday. He wanted his mail delivered because it was important from Germany. He had students working there. So a very resourceful Cornell hotel school student was at the lobby, took the mail that came in the next Saturday and divided it in half and gave him half of it on Saturday and half on Sunday. And the stock was perfectly satisfied with that. But when he went downtown with Dennis to start a bank account, he stormed into the bank and went past all the teller's windows up to, say, the manager at his desk in the back and said, "Wer spricht Deutsch here?" And of course, they didn't know what he was talking about. So he went from one teller to another, "Wer spricht Deutsch?" Nobody, of course. So Dennis watched all this, and they said, "You'll find anybody speaks German." Well, then he tried his French, a very Germanized French. They didn't know what he was talking about. Americans are so language deprived that they just don't know what's going on. But Stock gave his lectures in German, wrote his book in German, and it was translated. Stock needed a lecture assistant, and Dennis said, "Well, Rocco is my lecture assistant. You can have him." So I was lecture assistant. Hey, a very interesting job, because he had all of these slides, of course, German words and writing on them, but clear enough. He did experiments with his, not out on the table the way Dennis did, no. Stock had shipped over or brought with him the Zeiss epidioscope. I imagine you've never seen one.
No.
A device that used a powerful carbon arc as a light source and reflected light from, of course, books or whatever you had down inside, but mostly Stock, who was an expert glassblower, made tiny glass vessels for the experiment he wanted to show, and these fitted inside the black curtained enclosure of the epidioscope and put an enlarged picture on the huge screen back there, so he could show anything to anybody in a large lecture room this way. Great thing. The optics, I thought, were marvelous. Front surface mirrors and lenses this big. So I learned to use the epidioscope, and Cornell actually bought one that nobody else would use. Only two were sold in this country, one at Cornell and one at Harvard. Mm. When I got to Harvard many, many, many years later, that epidioscope was still in the basement. Arthur B. Lamb, a longtime editor of the JACS, had bought it, and he was the only one who would use it. And of course, when he became dean of the science faculty, dean of the arts faculty, it went in the basement, and I, for all I know, maybe it's still there. I'm getting far afield. What do you want to know?
No, I'm glad to hear the stock stories. I did want to talk a little bit more about Cornell. One of the things that I don't have is a list of your papers. I have a list of the books you published, but we never did get a copy of the list of the papers. Do you happen to have an extra set?
I have a list.
Oh, you have a bound volume, okay.
Maybe I never prepared a list. It's always changing anyways. And the other bound volume, as far as it goes, but the list. It's a picture of Dennis at the time he retired. I don't know if I have a list. Anyhow.
I'm just going to make a note of this one. I'll have to get a copy of this. This one from J. Kim Ed.
A list of publications. Complete bibliography. I believe. There's a list of books.
Yes, that I have.
The list of patents I can give you.
Oh, that would be also interesting.
Publications, no. I don't know, there are 160 odd or 170 publications. Books you have, you said.
Yes, books I have a list.
Don't need to give you that. Well, suffice it to say,
okay,
for the present, the list begins with a couple of papers I published as an undergraduate.
Oh, really?
At Cornell. And this impressed the Harvard people no end. As subject of my texture research work was fluorine, and especially the oxides of fluorine. I looked for oxyacids of fluorine and found indications of hypofluorous acid. Nobody would believe then, but thoroughly established now. So, preparation of fluorine by electrolysis, that was published in 1931, early 31, before I graduated. The oxyacids of fluorine, see the date on it, 1932, based on my work as a senior, oxyacids of fluorine, Roman II, which came the following year, fluorine preparation cell, and so on.
So you had a number of papers as an undergraduate then.
Yes.
Yes, that's...
And going right on up to... See, I don't regard this as a finished list because I published a paper just last year and continue to put them out. So... I give you a beginning and the end, but in between... computer could run this off for you if you wanted to for chem abstracts.
Yes, we can put more of a list together. I'll do that.
Main group chemistry news. There's an article in there from...
Is that the one last year? That's all right.
I have a lot of loose reprints, too, besides this bound volume, which only goes up to the time I retired from Harvard. And beyond that, there are loose things all over the place. Well, you're interested in the patents. Let's.
If you have a list, we'll get to that in a little bit when we get to your GE period.